A diver.
I know how to snorkel.
You used to live where?
On the islands.
What islands?
St. Croix and St. Thomas.
And you really didn't know how to snorkel.
I sure did.
What did you catch?
What did I catch?
Yeah, snorkeling.
Fear of going out into the ocean.
I snorkeled once and caught a cold.
Did you? Yeah. Actually, it's pretty neat.
Well, it's exciting.
I have a question, though, not about snorkeling or the ocean.
What is it?
What happens when I start missing somebody or something?
Who are you missing?
R51,
because you are not.
I haven't seen him like 3
this
weeks.
This is a laser.
Is he still alive? Is he still around? Or did you pull his plug?
You know, he went running off, created havoc all over the planet.
Take his batteries out.
Came back, and the guy's crazy.
We've decided
to keep him off of Science Live from now on.
Do you guys like that?
Well, no. Wait, let me tell you. He does these science fair projects, and they're crazy.
He doesn't quite get
He's going to make the kids all mixed up.
Yeah.
Well, I can show you what he did. You want to say it?
You have access to
that. Okay, Tina, 20 men. Hi, guys. Welcome to Area 51. This is where I live. It's because I'm R51, and I've got a lot of great things going on. First thing I want to do is I want to read my mail. Did you know I get mail? Look, I got this here letter, and it's all about love coming to R51, and it's got writing on the back. I want all you kids that have been sending me letters, thank you very, very much. I like my mail. Now it's time to get very, very serious about something. I have a question for Paige. I have to fix my card. See, this is my card, and I'm going to personalize it. There we go. R51. This is a card for Paige, right? I made this card, and I'm going to ask her a very difficult science question because she's very smart. She's probably the best scientist outside of Area 51. And here's my question. Paige, a few months ago it was so cold we were freezing. And now it's nice and warm outside. Why did it all of a sudden get warm, Paige? And just in case you don't know, this card says you have to answer the question. But you can't. You don't even know why it's nice and warm because you don't appreciate 51. It's nice and warm because of me. And here's how I did it. I invented flowers. And the flowers are what made it warm. Yes, it was cold. And then came the flowers. I invented the flowers. And when the flowers came, they just pushed the cold away. Now we got flowers. And it's not cold. Isn't that amazing? Lots of flowers right here in 51. See you soon. I rest my case.
Yeah, he talks nonsense. Paige is the best scientist. That's a bunch of
That's
malarkey.
Bloody. Well, no, seriously. He says that the reason that in the spring, as it's warming up, it's because he invented flowers.
Mm-hmm, right.
Now, we all know he invented everything, but or so he says, but it got warm, and there were flowers, so he says, I figured it out. It's because of the flowers that it got warm.
Mm-hmm.
But what if it got warm, and so the flowers came up?
Yeah, what if that happened?
Mm-hmm. And you see, in science, we learn how to create experiments to figure out exactly what did happen and why.
Right.
And someone that really studies this is going to notice something really peculiar. It got warm before the flower showed up.
Yeah.
That's kind of a clue that his hypothesis is wrong.
The clue.
Yeah, that was a clue. It could be that the warmth warmed up the bulbs and the flowers and up they came. Mm-hmm. But you know, that is the scientific method, to be able to make an invention, a discovery, and understand how things work. Sir Isaac Newton had a quote about hypotheses and good ideas.
He did.
You don't have to remember it, do you?
No. I can find
the
it real
smartest
fast.
Purse scientist in the world.
I know where to look. That's right, a good start. Okay.
That'd be a good challenge for you. But the scientific method it starts out with a philosophy that says we want to know the real truth. We don't want to know something but then be wrong. And so we start out by coming up with a question that we want to answer, and then we come up with our idea of what the answer is. And it's just our best guess based on what we know. We call it a hypothesis, which means we're almost always wrong. Okay, but we have a hypothesis. Then we figure out an experiment that we could do to figure it out, to discover it. In the case of why did the weather get warmer? One hypothesis would be maybe it's because the season changed. And of course, 51 has the idea, no, it's because of the flowers. Well, we say we could make an experiment where we put one of those time relapse cameras on a flower and watch it and watch the temperature, put a thermometer by it, and see if it gets warm before the flower comes up or the flower comes up before it gets warm.
We could.
And we could find it. Did you find your quote?
I did.
All right, let's hear it.
No great discovery was ever made without a bold guess.
A bold guess.
Sir Isaac Newton.
What a great name for a really good hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. A bold guess.
A bold guess. And bold means you take a chance on really being wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's how you really kind of push science forward. And in science fair projects, that's really kind of what we need to do. So why do the seasons change? Why does it get warm and then cold and warm and cold?
Oh, that's why we came to science for you to teach us.
It's going to be like that today.
Huh? Yeah.
Okay. Well, it is kind of interesting because I just happened to bring the world with me.
The whole world, look at that.
There it is. That is the world, it spins. And interestingly, we all know the Earth orbits around the sun. Does it orbit in a perfect sphere? Or does it have more of an elliptical orbit? Meaning that sometimes the Earth is closer to the sun than it is other times. And it turns out it is elliptical. And guess when the Earth is closest to the sun? What month? Because every year, it's the same month. And see, we could have a hypothesis. That's why it gets warmer, is because the sun gets closer. Right? Mm-hmm. We're going to see an eclipse on April 8th that completely blots out the sun because the moon got bigger, because it's closer to the Earth than it was during the last eclipse. So maybe it's just the sun's closer, so the Earth gets warmer. But there's some data that makes us wonder. For example, up in the northern hemisphere, when it's summer, like in the United States, down in the southern hemisphere, the southern part of the planet, like Australia and Brazil, it's winter. And when it's summer down there, it's winter up here. That makes the close to the sun theory not work. Another thing that's kind of interesting is the Earth is closest to the sun in the month of January, about our coldest month. So the little bit of difference of how close it is, it needs to be a lot closer to be warmer. If it was a lot closer, it would make a difference. But it is so far away that the little bit of difference in the orbit isn't enough to really make us warm. So what is it? And the magic turns out to be the fact that the Earth is on a tilt. You see when it spins that it's it's tilted at 23.5 degrees from straight up and down. You see that tilt? It's a pretty good tilt. Why does a tilt give us weather? And by the way, it's a darn good thing we have that. So I brought
a torch. A torch.
That's what they called them in the UK. Okay, a torch. And what I want to do is try and experiment and see if we can figure out why we get different seasons. Now remember, the Earth spins like this, and it stays at this angle all the way around the sun. So during the time of the year that we call summer, which would be June, the sun's over here, and so the tilt is towards the sun, so it puts the US, so we get direct sunlight. During the winter, sun's in the middle, it's over here, you bring the US around. Now the US is way up there, so the direct sunlight is down in Brazil, and we just kind of get a crooked skiff of sunlight, so we don't get as direct sun. But there's more than just that. Let's see if we can put the light on here. Can we dim these just a little bit, please? Okay. Light us up.
Where do you want it?
I want it on the Earth. Okay, good. You can see that this side of the Earth is having daytime. This side is having nighttime. And we look at the spin. The spin is so that the southern hemisphere is getting the direct sun. So I've got this set up now. If that were the sun in this relationship, this would be winter, okay? If I turn the spin around, which it would do by going halfway around the sun, then the Earth would be tilted so that the United States is facing the sun. And here's something interesting. If you look up here at the very tip top, which is the North Pole, you can see that it's in the sun. And now I'm going to have a 24-hour day. The Earth is turning like it does 24 hours. But you notice there's always sun here. And during the summer, the sun never sets at the North Pole. You say, well, wait a minute. Why is that? Well, it's because it's tilted. If it was tilted like that, it would never set either. But it's not tilted quite that far. But it's tilted enough that it never sets. But look at the South Pole now. It's in the shadow all day long. So during our summer, during the month of June, July, in the United States, up in North Alaska, the sun never goes down. And during the winter, if you turn it around up in Alaska, now the South Pole never gets dark. But the North Pole is always dark. The sun goes down in the fall, late fall, up at the North Pole, and they see it go down, and they know today's the last day we see the sun until the beginning of spring. Wow. And think about that. Now, I saw that when I went to lecture about hydrogen in Anchorage. I flew up right in the middle of winter.
Oh.
Big mistake. But I flew up there in the middle of winter, got out, it was really cold. People parked their cars at a little meter, and they'd get out and plug in a cable to keep their car warm so it would start when they came out. That's how cold it was. It was really cold. But in the morning, you could see over there on the east where the sun should be coming up, it was still dark, and you watch and watch. And about 11:30, finally it started to get a little bit light over there, like before sunrise. And boy, I was excited. I was ready for the sun. I was ready for the sun. And it got a little lighter, but before the sun came up, it started getting dark again. So it just got a little teeny glow on the east part of the sky, and then it was gone. And that was it. And yet during the summer, and I haven't been to Alaska in the summer, which I should do because it's a beautiful place, but during the summer, the sun comes up, and at night, it just goes down almost like it's going to set, but it doesn't quite, and it just starts coming right back up. Because, as you can see, no matter how you turn the Earth, the light's still on the North Pole. So it's this turning at an offset angle as we go around the sun that makes the seasons. And scientists like to know and understand and discover things like that. And that would be a great science fair. Now, you did a great job. Can we let her hear how grateful we are? Thank you, she. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. You know, I always knew that Atlas held up the Earth. Uh-huh. But now we know who holds the sun.
I wonder what happened, whoever's holding the sun, if they had an itch, because they don't.
Well, if you decide to do a science fair project to look at the sun and find out who it is, don't forget your glasses. Remember, we're just a week and a half away from the great April 8th eclipse. And remember, sunglasses, regular sunglasses, will not work for looking at the sun. If you can see through them, I'm looking at those bright lights, I can't see anything. The sun is so bright that to protect your eyes, you need special eclipse glasses. If you haven't ordered some, you're going to be where you want to look at the eclipse, and almost the whole United States can see the eclipse, just not the complete eclipse. So if you get your glasses, you order them, or you get them at the grocery store or somewhere, and you look at the sun on April 8th, just a little bit after lunch, you're going to see, looks like a big bite is eaten out of it, like a crescent moon. And you can see the shadow caused by the moon being in front of the sun. And it won't block it completely because you're in the wrong place. If you travel to that band where we are going to have a total eclipse, you see a lot. And our plan still is to stream live the eclipse experience from our watch parties. Now, it's kind of scary. Here we are. We're planning these watch parties. We've got a lot of people coming. And we were told by the Forest Service down where we're having our watch party that they expect so many people there that the cell phone towers will be overloaded and we probably won't get a good enough signal to broadcast live. We're going to try, okay? And if we can't, if perchance we can't just because the signal can't get through because too many people are there trying to broadcast live, well, then we'll film it and we'll broadcast it as soon as we get a signal so we can a little bit later in the day. So Science Live on April 8th will be showing you that, and I think it'll be a real interesting thing to see. The other thing is, what if there are clouds?
That happens.
What if there are clouds? Some people, some really crazy, fanatical eclipse watchers look at the forecast, look at the cloud patterns, and that, and then they get on an airplane, fly wherever there's no clouds.
Well, yeah, why not? No.
Are you one of those people? All right, but yeah. Anyway, it is exciting. I really want to make sure, I mean, a lot of people are interested and excited about the eclipse, and this is kind of the eclipse of eclipses.
It is.
In my total lifetime, I've seen a lot of eclipses, never a complete one like this before. I saw the last eclipse came through here, which was complete, but it was the kind where the moon was too far away, so it had a ring of fire around it, so it wasn't really a full eclipse. And we even went up on top of the Billings Tower to watch it. There was a whole bunch of us there, and when it was just about time, in came the clouds.
They sure did. But it was interesting because you could hear silence.
Yeah, you could see from up there, you could see clear over into Kansas. Mm-hmm. And you could see the darkness come. And it didn't get completely dark because that was a ring of fire eclipse, remember? Mm-hmm. But it got considerably darker. Mm-hmm. And as the darkness came over, and we were looking at it through the clouds, so we just saw the clouds get dark. But as it got darker, a very strange silence came with it. Mm-hmm. And it was...
The birds stopped.
The birds stopped.
It got cooler, too. The wasn't as warm.
Yeah, the razor. It was a different experience. Yeah. Watch it come through. It was kind of you know, science fiction. Maybe there really was an eclipse. We couldn't see. Well, hopefully this time we will. And those of you that have things to share about your experience with it, feel free to send them to us. We'll see what we can get up, okay?
Are you taking questions tonight?
Just a minute. Am I taking questions tonight?
Dominic would like you to take a question.
So am I? I am. I definitely am. I have it officially. Yes.
So if the Earth was slightly rotated in the opposite direction from which it already rotated in, how would that affect human society?
I wonder if he's talking about the tilt.
I think that's...
Well, if it was tilted a little bit different angle, it would change when our summer and our winter is. Mm-hmm. If the amount of tilt was more... In fact, not even very much more, well, then probably the Earth would have a very hard time supporting all the life we have on it. Yeah. There are so many things about the Earth that are absolutely perfect. For the size of our sun, which just happens to be how big it is, the Earth is exactly the right distance from the sun so that we get freezing ice during the winter, and we get liquid water over most of the planet, and life can survive. It's really interesting. It's a miracle. You think it's just so easy. And when you try to raise plants, it's hard. You know, people go to school, and they buy all kinds of chemicals and books and things to try and get their gardens to grow. And yet, out in the wild, everything just grows, and it grows better than it does in our gardens. It's really amazing. So it's like it's well planned, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's really amazing. Okay, well, I need to get on a little bit more to the science fair. A lot of students are sending in questions because we've talked a lot about the science fair. A lot of people want to do science fair projects, and maybe I've kind of left us off a charge in the wrong direction, but a lot of very young, even elementary age students, want to know what science fair project can they do to completely revolutionize the world.
Yep, they do.
And
it's got to be big.
Even some of the greatest minds that have ever lived in science started out younger, and they had to learn with more simple science fair projects to start with. One of the things that I would strongly recommend to many of you younger students for your science fair project isn't to reinvent the whole universe. You can do that when you get a little older. What if your project were to learn everything that can be learned about something you're really interested in? Could be frogs. What if you learned everything there is to know about frogs, or frog eggs, or tadpoles, or all of it, mm-hmm. or butterflies, or anything that you're really interested in? And that's how my science fair project started. In the beginning, I didn't build hydrogen cars. I mean, that was my last 3 years of school, high school, and it took me 3 years to finally get the thing to work, and even that was by a little bit of luck. But before that, I did projects where I learned so much about something. And a science fair project where you really learn about something can be reported as a science fair project and can be very interesting. And it's a good way to start. I really enjoyed hearing Tobias speak about masers, microwave emissions by stimulated emissions, lasers. Light amplification by stimulated emissions of radiation. Because that's one of the things that I became very, very interested in at an early age. In my second year of high school, my second formal science fair, I was working on my hydrogen engine again, and I didn't know enough to get it working that year, and I tried and tried, and finally when I could see it's just not gonna happen, I put it away. And I said, okay, I'm gonna do another project. And the project that I chose was a laser project. And lasers are amazing. And then they were quite new. This was in 1964. And so I wanted to build a laser. And there were quite a few things going about it. We got to the point where we were sending computer signals over a laser beam through a fiber of glass, fiber optic light. But it has to be a laser light in order to go these long distances over fiber. And one of the problems that I read about is that when you shoot a laser beam through a fiber of glass that goes a long distance, it goes 100 miles, 150 miles, every mile the light goes through the glass, it gets a little more dim and a little more dim and a little more dim until finally it's so dim that you can't pick up the signal on the other end. And so if you want it to go clear across country, you have to amplify it about every 100 miles. And the way that they would amplify that signal in those days is they would capture the light and they would turn it from light back into electricity. And then they would amplify the electricity and they'd put it back in a new laser and send it another 100 miles. And that station was very, very expensive. And my idea was you have this light beam that's all modulated with all this data you're trying to send. What if you could just amplify it without turning back into electricity? It would save a fortune. And I had a theory that I thought I could do that. And my idea was to build a laser that wasn't really a laser per se, but it's what I called a laser amplifier. And Tobias did such a nice introduction of how these lasers work. And, you know, light amplification by stimulated emissions of radiation. And he talked about how in a laser, you have to take a gas, or it could be something like a ruby rod, mm-hmm. and you have to pump energy into it so that the atoms get excited. And of course, when atoms get excited, what really happens is electrons go to bigger, faster orbitals. And so when they jump up, they absorb energy. And then eventually, in fact, right away, they fall back down and they give off light of a particular color. That's how a neon sign works. So if you have a tube with neon in it, a low-pressure neon, and you put a high voltage of electricity through it, it'll glow. And that's neon lights that we see around towns. We used to see more. They're pretty. And if you put different gases in, you get different colors. Well, that's a neon light. If you want to make a laser, now you've got to do something a little bit more clever. A neon light just comes out of the tube in every direction, and it's a pretty color. It's all the same color, but it isn't a beam. With a laser, we wanted to make a beam. And in Einstein's paper, he talked about how you could stimulate an emission. And this is something kind of fun to understand. Can we go through it for a minute? Mm-hmm. And the reason that I want to talk about this is because I really learned about this so I could do a science fair project. And I still remember it, and it's opened many doors for me. If you really, really, really learn everything you can about something you're really interested in, that is a great science fair project. And that should give a lot of you, especially some of you younger people, a boost on getting started. So let's go back to this laser. In the case of a gaseous laser, a helium laser, if you just put helium in and run some electricity, high voltage to it, it'll glow. I didn't want that. That won't make a laser. If you want to make a laser, what you have to do is when those electrons get pumped up, you've got to get them to stay at that high energy state. And that's hard to do because when energy comes in, they go up and they come right down like a neon sign. And so they do it with something like doping. And then even with the ruby, they had to do that. With the ruby rods, they doped them, which means you put just a little pinch of an impurity in. And I believe with the ruby rods, they use chromium. And what that meant is when you pump a ruby rod with light. Remember that strobe light he showed us? You pump it with light, the light goes in, excites the ruby electrons to go high, and if there's just a little impurity of chromium in there, they don't stay up, but they stay up for a while. You know, we're talking like thousands of a second, but they stay up for a little while. And that makes it possible to get what scientists call a population inversion, where there's enough of them excited that you can make a laser. So you've got to get them pumped up, and then you've got to get them to stay there. Chromium helps to get them to stay there. With a neon, for a neon laser, you dope it with helium. So it's called a helium neon laser. And when you stimulate it, it pumps the atoms up. The electrons shoot up to higher orbitals. They absorb that energy from some source. And then if they stay up there long enough, if there happens to be one photon of light that is going right straight down the middle of the tube and it passes an excited atom, that's the stimulated emission. Because the excited atom will let its electron fall down and it will shoot out another photon in perfect sync with the first one. So now you have one, and then after it goes past this atom, you have two. And then they pass another atom. And since it's excited, they get three and four. And then on both sides of the tube, they put mirrors. So if it's going right down the middle, it hits the mirror and they're focused, so it comes right back. Now some of the light goes out the side and it's just lost. But as it's going down the middle, it's caught in between those mirrors. So it goes back and forth and gets brighter and brighter until pretty soon there's so much light right in sync that the atoms that are excited are all giving off their light with the beam, and finally gets so strong it can go right through the mirror. And now it has to be a special mirror. If you use something like just a silver coating, it won't do. But the mirrors you use on lasers, at least the ones I built, were dielectric coatings, which were very, very reflective. 99.5% of the light would be reflected, but the other part would go through when it got strong enough, and so a beam would come out. Now, I want to make a laser without the mirrors because I wanted to modulate the light beam and then have it go through my amplifier and show I could amplify it with all the data and everything in it without losing the data and have it come out the other end stronger. That was my science fair project. And I'll just show you young R working on, there he is. Aww. Look at that. And look at that helium neon laser. Now this wasn't the laser amplifier. This was the laser because the only way I could test the amplifier was to have a laser. And boy, they were very hard to buy back then. So this was my laser. And if you notice in the background, my ham radio transmitter. That is how I excited the laser. Pumped it up with my ham radio so that I would get the signal strong enough and it would pump that up, and I did get this laser to work. However, it was hard. I had to make Brewster angle windows and I had to use quartz for the glass in the windows, and by the time I got all that stuff working, the science fair was over.
Excuse me, sir, how did you know the ham radio thing would help you excite your laser?
I was excited about ham radio. Read. When you're doing a project like this, you just want to learn all you can. And like I always lament, the internet was down right then.
But it said a ham radio would.
Well, it said, no, it didn't say a ham radio. It says a radio could excite it. You can excite it also with just a high voltage AC. I got a neon sign transformer that put out 30,000 volts and it would light it up, but it had so much AC noise on it, it wouldn't work as a laser. So then I read that a radio transmitter would work, and I thought about going down to the big station downtown, but I didn't think they appreciated science yet. So since I had this in my bedroom,
You had no fear. You just go and you just ask.
It's crazy, huh?
That's crazy. Yeah.
Now we know where 51 came from, don't we? But anyway, so this project didn't make the science fair. And this is my junior year of high school.
Okay.
So my senior year, I did the hydrogen car. But I finished the project, even though I missed the science fair. And then my chemistry teacher told me about the Westinghouse science search, which was another contest, which I entered and I won with this project. So I was glad I did it.
Wow.
But I learned so much about stimulated emissions. One of the wonderful papers that came out of Einstein during his miracle year, they call it a miracle year because in one year, this one guy, a patent agent, completely revolutionized modern science with all these ideas.
He had a lot of ideas, didn't he? They just kept coming.
And he just, he got so many things right. Mm-hmm. And remember, the thing that really launched him into mainstream was an eclipse. An eclipse that allowed scientists to see stars coming right by the sun because he predicted that the mass of the sun would warp space-time, which would make the stars appear to be in different positions than they normally were. And they had photographs of when they weren't by the sun, and he had made a calculation of how much they should move. And if they moved exactly the amount he calculated, then there's a darn good chance he was exactly right about what was happening. And you remember the story about how when he made that calculation, he made a math error, an embarrassing math error. And when they went to do the measurement, things happened and they weren't able to do the measurement. Yep. And so they had to wait for another eclipse to come along. And while he was waiting for someone else to bring an eclipse, someone pointed out to him, look, this may be a math error. And sure enough, it was. And he found it and he fixed it. And thank goodness he did it before the eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it really, really was a big thing. So I am very grateful for everything I learned about lasers. Now, the thing that I didn't anticipate when I was inventing my laser amplifier was that some dude would invent a thing called a solid state laser, a laser diode. Because this is just a little twerpy crystal thing, like yay big, it's easy to make. And now, at the end of 100 miles, you just run it through a little inexpensive thing and shoot out the other side. So we didn't end up needing this for that. But the very laser amplifier technology that I was working on, and they didn't get this from me, but scientists at Los Alamos Laboratory are using big, long ones to amplify laser beam so they can do implosion fusion experiments.
How do you know they didn't get it from you?
Did they?
I don't know. I'm just wondering
well,
how you know.
I don't think they did. I think they figured it out. And
oh.
I don't, you know, I'm not claiming.
I know.
But it was interesting to me that at least I'm the first one that thought about just making an amplifier like that. And if it would work in a laser, I figured take the mirrors off and make it long enough and excited enough that then a weak beam could come in one side and it would get stronger and stronger and stronger when it came out the other side. And it does.
And it does.
And that's what they do. Yeah. In implosion, they take a little BB of fuel, and this would be deuterium, tritium, some form, those are isotopes of hydrogen that they want to fuse into helium, and they need to get it very hot and compressed, and so they do it by hitting it with a giant light beam. But the light beam has to be so big, there's no laser big enough. And it has to also come from every direction because they want it to implode or explode into an inside direction. So what they do, they can't fire all the lasers perfectly at the same time. So instead, they fire one laser, and then they have splitters, like a prism, that separate it and run it through multiple amplifiers. And I think they have something like 34 of these that, and I'm not sure on that number, but it goes through them all, and then it comes in with mirrors and things from all different directions at exactly the same instant. And they've actually been able to create helium and give off energy by doing that. So because I did a science fair project where I learned about it, it put me right into these things. And science fair projects give you practical knowledge as you build these experiments and do it. I think a wonderful science fair project is to be able to duplicate something wonderful that someone has already done. Mm-hmm. But you learn how to do it, and it puts you in a position then to march up the ladder of your career. You cannot push science forward to the next step until you've learned the past steps. You have to pay your dues. You want to stand on the shoulders of giants, as Sir Isaac Newton once said. So if I've seen more, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants. So you want to learn the science we already have. And when you're right on that cutting edge, then you have a chance to push the cutting edge forward. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. Well, I think we're out of time, but I wish you all very well. It's time to get real serious about those science fair projects. Learn everything you can about something that you're passionate about. Put that up as your science fair project, and you'll be surprised. You do a real good job. You got a good chance of winning prizes. See you next time. Bye-bye.